petition number 20984, Reel 1.
Captain Phillips, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in London.
Which year was this?
On May the 11th, 1922.
Can you tell me about your schooling, please?
Yes, that's not very distinguished. But I firstly went to a school in Farnborough, near Aldershot, where my father had been, and where the headmaster was a great friend of his, and where, unfortunately, there was very, very serious bullying. So bad was it that on the first night of the holidays, after my first term there, my mother came into the bathroom when I was having a bath, and she was absolutely horrified to see bruises and things all over my back and my bottom. And my father was horrified, rang up the headmaster, and I was one of 27 boys who were taken away as a very bullying maths master who used to strike us with every sort of thing, including billiard cues. And the headmaster, who in fact was a very nice man, had left discipline to his assistant headmaster and didn't really know what was going on, I don't think. Anyway, I was taken away, and one of the boys who was not taken away by his parents settled the whole matter by burning the school down the next term, which was quite a strong way of dealing with the matter. I then went to a very nice prep school called Beechborough Park, near Folkestone in Kent, and that was a very happy place. But my progress educationally, it was not very brilliant, and it was quite obvious that I was not going to pass the common entrance exam. I was down to go to Eton, where my father and his father and his father had been, and the headmaster was a very nice chap, said, I think we'd better get a tutor in the holidays, because the boy is not exactly a genius. So my parents got hold of this very nice tutor who came every holidays, in fact was a master at this school, Beechborough. And although he tried his best, and I had great confidence in him, it wasn't good enough, and I failed the first time in the common entrance to go to Eton. I was then put under the care of a man called Gerald Martineau, who was a well-known poet. He wrote a poem, usually on sport of some sort, in the field every week. A marvellous man and a very good poet, but never really made the very top. And he tutored me, and I went into the Chester Hotel in Chester Square in London, and he and his wife looked after me, and he tutored me every day. And I was also extremely well helped by a very fine man called Canon Elliot, who had a daily column, I think it was 5 days a week, in what was then the Daily Sketch. He was a marvellous man. He was the vicar of St. Michael's Chester Square, and he was staying in the hotel to have the vicarage done. As it happened, I believe both the hotel was bombed out of recognition, and so, I believe, was his vicarage later in the war. But he was a very influential man, and he tried to teach me a bit of English. He said, if you can write a bit, you'll get through anything, but there's something obviously a bit wrong with you. It's word, there's a word those days, I think that your word process didn't work quite too well in your brain. Of course, it was dyslexia, but I was 36 when it was confirmed that I was a very, very bad dyslexic. I'd never been so relieved to be told that I was something very bad, because, as you know, the boys at school thought I was a bit potty, and the master thought I was just bone idle. And it was a hellish disease to have. But it's a great challenge in everything you do for the rest of your life. And now I am a member of the Institute of Dyslexia, and they've been extremely helpful, and I've been able to write a couple of books. So that was really the basic education. But Mr. Martineau was so good and so patient that he actually got me into Eton. I passed the common entrance examination and went to Eton, where I found it extremely difficult to keep up with the other boys. In fact, there's always an exam called trials at the end of every term, and I failed in pretty well all of them. Fortunately, I was quite a good athlete. These days, I suppose it wouldn't count so much. And I had a marvelous housemaster, a Wickhamist, who had been badly shot up in the First World War, called J.D. Upcott. And he seemed to have a bit of faith in me, and otherwise I would have been superannuated. But I managed to stay the course at Eton and had really a very, very happy childhood. My parents made life very happy at home, and so did my housemaster and my many friends at Eton. Then, of course, came the war. Now, I'm afraid that was rather a long-winded answer to your question on my education.
That's fine. How did you come to be in the army?
Well, again, I think I was more or less going to go into the army anyway if I could have passed to get into Sandhurst and out of Sandhurst. But also, my father was a lieutenant colonel in the 60th Rifles. He'd been right the way through the 14-18 war. And he had always thought that I might be a reasonably good soldier, but we had competition from my mother's side of the family, in that my ancestor was a man called General Monk, who restored the monarchy and formed the Coast Stream Guards. And so there was a bit of a tussle between my mother and father as to whether I go into the 60th, or try to go into the 60th, or the Coast Stream Guards. And that's really, in the end, my mother won. And so I was down for the Coast Stream. I was interviewed, I think I was 13, in Birdcage Walk. And they said, well, if you can make it, my reports weren't very good academically, come to us. So that's how it happened. But unfortunately, of course, I couldn't pass the exams.
When was this?
This is in 1940. So, for the time being, my father said, I'm going to give you a chance to learn a bit about military matters. And he'd just been made the commanding officer of a large part of Staffordshire, most of North Staffordshire, for the Home Guard, Dad's Army. And he said, you've been in the OTC. I think you might be able to command the Hollington Company, which was about four villages spread over a rather wild bit of North Staffordshire. And it was rather ridiculous. There were these old boys from the 14-18 war, and there I was, an 18-year-old company commander. Excuse me. And it was a very good start-up. And then eventually I thought I must try and get into the army proper, and I joined the ranks of the Berkshire Regiment at Reading, sent down to Cornwall, where there was a battalion which they called the Prisoner and Borstal Battalion, of fairly tough boys, and we were stationed near Padstow, and we did all the bays, Tregaron, Harlin, guarding St. Mirren Airport, which was then being used by the Navy, the Royal Navy, and St. Devil, which was being used by the Royal Air Force. And we were guarding those two aerodromes and the coastal line.
Which battalion was this?
This was, I think it was the 8th Battalion of the Royal Berkshires. There my memory is a bit slippery, but I've got that actually in my book somewhere, I think. And there I stayed for best part of a year. A difficult period in a way, because a lot of these lads didn't think much of the public school boys, and one had various names. One of the main one was College C. I won't pronounce the actual word, but let's say it's rather a female word. But I was fortunately able to box, not very well. I was a sort of slugger, fairly good straight left, a very inaccurate swinging right. But after I won one or two competitions regimentally, particularly against the Duke of Wellington's, when our chap funked going in to fight a very strong, huge man of 6'6", I was then accepted. And the College C was knocked out, and they just called me Phil. And they were rather fine. But it was a difficult period in some ways, because I knew that sooner or later I'd have to start passing or trying to pass exams. And eventually, having helped the Cash brothers, who were two fairly notorious criminals, that's not their real name, I used it in my autobiography, once without knowing it, carrying bags back to barracks and hiding them in a hedge where I didn't know what was inside, but in fact I later learnt that they were pennies, sixpences and shillings, which they'd taken from all the call boxes, the telephone boxes. After that they went to the station to say goodbye to me, and one or two of my fellow Etonians actually had joined by that time. It was very popular, the Royal Barracks at that time, with Eton. And the extraordinary thing is the Borstolian seemed to get on extremely well with the Etonian. And so three of us, Robbie Muir, also went into the Coldstream, Johnny Horlick, who of the Horlicks family, he never drank any Horlicks as far as I know himself, and Johnny Ferguson Cunningham, who went into the Scots Guards and won a very fine MC. Robbie Muir, who married the Duke of Marlborough's daughter. It was a very good experience for the three of us. Well, the four of us in the end. And it taught me an awful lot about life, and I shall never regret it. In fact, I'm very grateful for that period.
Any ideas as to why the ex-Borstal boys should have got on so well?
It's a very good question, that, because it is a difficult one to answer, but I think there was a certain sympathique. I think that the Borstal boys thought that we were a load of creeps. And the funny thing is that so many of those chaps, and I don't know why, there were a lot of Birmingham people in the Berkshire Battalion, loved sport and athletics. They hadn't had much chance, really, to run or play games. And that is why much later on, after the war, I was chairman of the Gloucester Playing Field Association. And I think there was a certain amount of admiration physically, because on the whole, the four of us were good, fairly good games players. And the other thing is that I think some of the people they'd met who were not exactly aristocratic, put it that way, were looked down on them, or they thought that they looked down on them. And I don't think the Eton boys ever did. It was one of the most unsnobbish places in those days. I don't know what it's like now. And my parents were very unsnobbish. My mother became a peeress of the realm, and she was the most unsnobbish woman I've ever known. And so I think it was a good relationship. And we also had that rather silly, we shared that rather silly sort of sense of humour. Where when things went absolutely wrong, and when some of these lads were put into prison, they were able to still tell a very funny story about it. And in a silly sort of similar way, I think so were some of the Eton boys. And that's why I think quite a lot of those boys made very good officers. they seem to get on and seem to care for their men rather more than in other places.
What happened after Cornwall?
After Cornwall, Sandhurst said that they'd have me and that there would be no entrance because I'd done a year in the ranks. I ended up as a corporal. And they said, that's okay, and in we went. And so I went to Sandhurst and found it very difficult academically. Same old difficulties, word difficulties and so on. If I had to write 45, I might write 54 and still do. It's not so good when you write checks, but there we are.
Any other comments about the Sandhurst course?
Well, I enjoyed it. It was tough, particularly if you were a brigade of guards entrant, if you were dying for it. And it then came the final pass out examination, which of course I failed. This was my habit. And yet I had two marvellous friends, or became friends, who were my two instructors. The company commander, Major Tom Oakeshott, who funnily enough lived in Bagshot, so he was called by everybody Oakeshott, the big shot from Bagshot, and a very nice man, very smart, very good Welsh Guards officer. And Tom Harvey, who later became the Queen's private secretary and Queen Mother now, of course, and was a very good Scots Guards officer. And when I failed, they both helped me enormously. And I think, I hate to say this, because they were marvellous men and very honest men, they lied to their back teeth and didn't think that I was very well. That's what they said to the commandant. And so I was allowed, because I wasn't very well, to take the examination, I think it was 2 days later, again. And before that, both Captain Tom Harvey and Major Tom Oakeshott had about 4 hours hard work on me in the evening. I don't think they actually told me the answers, but looking back on it, I think they went fairly near to it. I'd done all the field work and the exercise operations apparently quite well. And that is why I think they had a little bit of faith in me. And Tom Oakeshott stood by the door, by the boys' mess, one afternoon. He said, oh, by the way, you can go and get your uniform for the Coast Stream Guards. You're now Second Lieutenant Mark Phillips. And it was really entirely due to them.
How did you feel about that?
Thrilled, absolutely thrilled. Because if I had been RTU'd, return to unit. If I had been, I would have felt very much I'd let my parents, who've been so good to me, die, and lots of other people. And so I was absolutely thrilled, and also I sort of felt the ghost of old General Monk looking down on me, saying, the boys set us down, and all that nonsense. No, it was a great day.
And then?
Then to Purbright, which was a marvellous experience. I don't think I've ever come across a greater sort of, this sounds pompous, but greater comradeship at all ranks, all levels. And I think because the Coast Stream was always a very family regiment, one really got on well with everybody. It didn't matter whether they were colonels, majors, captains, sergeant majors. Sergeant majors could be a bit tough on us, but they were marvellous. And all ranks. And I don't know, it was a very, very good experience. And we became more or less men. Not quite sometimes, but we still kiddied around a bit. And then we went from Purbright to Regent's Park Barracks, which was the holding battalion, ready to go to service battalions. And from there we did, in those days, the King's Guard, quite a bit of a march from Regent's Park, That again, I thought was very exciting. To me, I never ever felt quite so proud, really, as marching through the gates with the band playing to change the guard. It was a terrific experience. To me, a very moving one. And, one can be sentimental about these things, but the ceremonial, I reckon, was far better than any other country, whether it was the Trooping the Colour or whether it was Mounting the Guard or the Royal Tournament. And so from there we went to Regent's Park Barracks, and only for about 6 or 7 months, and then we were called for by the 2nd Battalion Coldstream Guards to go up to Scotland, where at that moment they were a commando battalion. My own view was that guardsmen are never very brilliant commandos, because there's some very tall ones, and their heads would stick up above the landing craft, and they were rather easy targets. And the other thing was that we moved with precision, whereas commandos ought to run and roar around the place, firing from very odd positions. The guardsman was so well disciplined, he was still rather inclined to march in line. Sergeant Major of the East Pay Stick, our Sergeant Major still did that in North Africa later. Keep the line, boys, and that was rather us. I think we did as well in action as any commando, but it was different. And we were commando for about, I suppose, 9 months. Later, we stationed at Blairgowrie. We did the training at Inverary, where Lord Lovett, himself an ex-guardsman, kept a very fatherly eye on us. Jimmy Lovett became a great friend of mine. I was always a bit frightened of him, but he was, I think, one of the bravest men I ever saw, and a very distinguished man in every way. And so that was that bit of the war, the training bit. We went down to do a raid on the French coast, but the Germans knew it from the moment we left Blairgowrie, because all the laundry was said to be going to Cowes, Isle of Wight, where we were to launch off from. And the trucks were marked out Portsmouth, Isle of Wight. And so I think it wouldn't be very difficult for the Germans to know exactly where we were off to. And when we arrived in the Isle of Wight, there was a German craft, far too high to be shot down, hovering over us the whole time. And as we marched up the hill at Cowes, we were machine gunned by the Luftwaffe. They knew we were coming. That annoyed the local elderly residents from the Royal Yacht Club. They weren't mad keen on being machine gunned in their main street. Anyway, that was that. We were in Norris Castle, which was bombed that night. So they knew we were coming. We were then put aboard the, the Prince Albert, that's right. The Prince Albert, the mothership. And there we were to take a radar station, not far from Dieppe. It was only about 3 weeks before Dieppe, the fateful Canadian raid. And there we were to take this radar station. And I remember it very well indeed. Robert Dougal was a young little BBC reporter who was with us. The most amusing man, who we all became very fond of. And I sat next to him when the briefing was done by Lord Lovett. And I believe Lord Louis Van Batten came alongside, but we didn't actually see him, because then he was very much involved in combined operations. And I sat on the other side of Robert Dougal, who was a civilian. And when the briefing was given in the wardroom, he had to stand up to show himself so we could all recognize him. And he was to wear a squadron leader's uniform. And he had the slightly unfortunate name of Homo. And of course, there was a bit of giggling in the back ranks then from the officers. But he was a very nice and a very brave man. And he was to actually, he was an expert on radar. He was to dismantle it and either destroy it or bring it back. It was going quite well. We tried to give squadron leader Homo, never been near a battle in his life, a little bit of chair in the wardroom, the odd gin and tonic. And Robert Doole and I, and he played Shove Halfpenny and tried to cheer him up a bit, because he was told that if we saw him to be taken by the Germans, we were to shoot him. And yet there was a damn good chance that he was going to be shot by the Germans anyway. He was a very brave man. I don't know what happened to him. And then, unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't know which, we got onto our landing craft, infantry, LCIs, and an almighty wind blew up. And we were recalled. Although I believe number two commando had a company that got ashore. But it was, unfortunately, a failed operation. Whether it affected the DF raid or not, I wouldn't know. So that was that bit, shall we say, United Kingdom part of the war, and then off we went to the landing in North Africa on White Beach at Algiers.
Can you tell me about how you got there, please?
We got there in, I suppose, one of the most uncomfortable ships that's ever been constructed, called the Neer Hellas. Don't ask me how to spell it. It was a Dutch boat, I believe, and it was so cramped, it was absolute hell for the guardsmen. All of them, or very nearly all of them, really, were cramped and were very sick. It was a very rough crossing. We went out from Glasgow. It was, I can't remember a great deal about it. I do remember leaving Blairgowrie, where we marched through for the last time to Blairgowrie station. That was a very moving time, because the whole of Blairgowrie turned out to wish us well. They didn't know, nor did we know, unlike the other white. We didn't know where we were going or anything at all. And it was a very memorable day. A lot of the guardsmen had married Scotch lasses, and there were quite a few tears. We then went from Glasgow and joined what we thought was not a very big convoy in the Irish Sea. And then we sailed into the Atlantic, where we became part of a huge convoy. I mean, the mind boggled, it was so enormous. And sort of destroyers and cruisers all swishing around with a fairly strong air cover above us. And we went out, and we still didn't know where we were going. Excuse me. And it was really very mysterious. Even the officers, I say even the officers, but they were very cramped in cabins for two. Six of us lying far too close together. And we wondered where the devil we were going. We zigzagged around the Atlantic and then came straight in to Gibraltar. Again, we didn't know what was going to happen, but we reckoned it must be somewhere in the Mediterranean. And there was a marvelous night, and we looked out from our cabin windows, and there was Gibraltar standing majestically above us. It looked almost as if we could touch it. And we thought, my God, now the U-boats are going to have a bit of fun. But in fact, then, we were very lucky. We didn't get torpedoed. The Queen Alexandra nurses, their ship was. And they were marvellous. Fortunately, there weren't too many casualties. But they lost a lot of equipment and their uniforms. And poor girls were put into very rough battle dress for a period. Anyway, that was the sailing through, and the first day out we got our final briefing that we were to go on attack the Free French on White Beach. In fact, there were very few Free French around.
Vichy French.
Yeah. And it was a very straightforward landing. And we took the town, got a sort of semi-friendly welcome from the civilians. And then we were given a task a week later of being the burial party to Admiral Darlon, who was really he was a traitor, really, to the French. And we were very cross that we had to be the...